Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Girl, real talk. This whole, it's new year, time to reinvent myself trash is not the vibe for 2024. You can find someone who loves you for you, as you are. You don't need to read a stack of self-help books, only eat sad salads, or like start meditating at 5 a.m. to be ready for dating. So yeah, my advice is to download Bumble and find someone who embraces you the way you are right now. Let me know how it goes.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Big box retailers, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a bill in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. Senate Bill 1838 would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, visit handsoffmyrewards.com and tell them to oppose credit card routing legislation paid for by the Electronic Payments Coalition.
I think that version of me had sort of died, actually. Like, and I had become not a completely different person, but someone who was meaningfully differently motivated, I think, in the kinds of things I cared the most about and the ways in which I wanted to use, like, my art making.
I'm Jordan Kistner, and you're listening to Thresholds, a weekly series of free-ranging conversations with writers and artists about moments of epiphany or transformation that changed their lives and their work. A moment that they stepped across, like a threshold, into something new, and the way that experience changed everything they wrote afterwards.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Big box retailers, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a bill in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. Senate Bill 1838 would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, visit handsoffmyrewards.com and tell them to oppose credit card routing legislation paid for by the Electronic Payments Coalition.
Quick note, I, Jordan, am taking a brief break from hosting this spring to work on some other projects. And while I am off mic, we are really lucky to have Mira Jacob occupying the interviewer seat. Mira is a novelist, a graphic memoirist, and an all-around brilliant mind and excellent conversationalist. She was our very first Thresholds guest, and I have never stopped wanting to listen to her talk. I also was excited by who she wanted to talk to for these shows. I'll be back later in the spring, but until then, Mira's got the host mic.
There's this distinctly American fantasy about art that comes easily. An artist who seemingly materializes brilliance out of thin air in no time. It's something that we really love to say as if less work somehow makes something even more genius. So if you've been following the trajectory of Sarah Thuncombe Matthews, whose book, All This Could Be Different, was a finalist for the 2022 National Book Awards, you've heard some version of this, that she wrote the book in 4 months, that it came out perfectly and brilliantly with little effort. But here's the thing, that story, in this case, is a huge oversimplification. As you'll hear in this interview, it does not consider the decade she spent working on another novel only to have it not hold together. It doesn't consider the time spent holding the heartbreak of having that book not hold together. Above all, it doesn't allow for the reality of Sarah, which is that she works really hard and is still a genius.
My partner and I decided to visit friends in LA and San Francisco and do a road trip between both those places. And when I was in Big Sur, had probably one of the scariest experiences of my life, which was we were on a completely deserted beach, despite it being Big Sur because of mudslides on Highway 1. And I got pulled out by a rip current. And so it was this thing that happened to me that, you know, I really was very changed by. It was a genuinely terrifying moment, partly because it really snuck up on me. You know, all of a sudden, like I felt like I was in the most beautiful place in the world at 8 a.m. in the morning, like just true paradise, splashing in the waves. I'm very much a water baby. I grew up in Oman, a mile away from the beach. Like, I love the ocean. I love water. And it very much, my whole life has felt like the place that I belong. And I was so in love with this beach and being in the water after so long that I didn't want to leave. And I just stayed in ice cold Pacific Ocean water for like 45 minutes and was body surfing by myself at this point. And all of a sudden I noticed that the cliffs, which ring this particular beach, Sand Dollar Beach, were all like, they had been really large. And all of a sudden they were tiny and over, you know, the course of 5 minutes. So the short of it, too late. But yeah, I think the short of it was, you know, I experienced, I think, maybe the most harrowing 10 minutes of my life where, you know, my partner had gone, and I knew this, my partner had gone to the car to get towels. And he was like, hey, don't like stay out too long. You've been in here for a while. And I was like, I'll be out in a minute. And then I just stayed. Yeah, I basically started swimming like crazy for the shore. And I just remember somewhere in my lizard brain, I remembered, you know, that you shouldn't try to swim like directly back to shore. If you're in a rip, you should try to swim. The actual science is swim parallel to the shore. But I remembered it as diagonal.
Yeah, I remember it's diagonal too. Okay, so it's parallel. Okay.
It's parallel. I actually think diagonal probably also saved my life because I really had so little energy left, which is part of the problem. But I think I just had one of those surges of adrenaline that, you know, allow moms to like lift cars off of their kids or something. Like I'm not the strongest person. And I just was like, you know, a rip current travels at like 8 miles an hour every minute or like 8 miles a minute or something crazy like that. So I just was like going and going and going. When I couldn't, like, I just knew it was really important to not fully give over to panic, which is very difficult in those moments. And so, my brain was just like, don't panic, you know, every moment that you feel like your arms can't go, flip up on your back and scream. And so I just did that. And when I was really striking out with desperation, being like, okay, I think this might be the end. Like, I, you know, like maybe 30 seconds later, my feet hit the sand, like hit a sandbar. My partner like saw me, you know, like at this point had been looking for me. It was a very big beach. Helped like drag me out of the water. I like collapsed on the surf and started like cackling with laughter. So anyways, a long and somewhat, you know, harrowing story. But I think the reason why I thought of that was it really changed me in ways that I didn't understand at the time. It felt a little bit like something had been introduced to me that I didn't know what to do with, which was the fact of my own death, you know, my own death and mortality and like the frailty of my body. I think in some ways, you know, like some people do ayahuasca and part of the experience that they're looking for is a certain kind of ego death, you know, that happens in this intense way over, you know, like a 6 to 8 hour stretch or what have you. What I felt like happened to me was that experience of getting dragged out by the current. It was like the sourdough starter of ego death. So I went to, you know, and like 4 days later, I went to the Iowa Writers Workshop to start an MFA program. And it was very strange. You know, I think that like I really was in denial that happened to me and in fact felt shame at sort of letting myself like get into that like situation and didn't talk to many people about it outside of close friends. I didn't tell my parents or what have you because I was just like, well, it would just worry them. And I realized in retrospect that I was a pretty messed up over it because I would be meeting people at the like welcome barbecue at Iowa. And I would just like hear, and whenever I was get a little bit stressed, I would hear like rushing ocean waves. But I think the reason this struck me as a threshold, you know, partly was timing, right? I was like, oh, I'm ready to change my life, you know, and try to become a writer. But when I say it was the sourdough starter of ego death, I think that in moments when I worked on my then project and felt doubt, I would think about, I would just have this involuntary returned image of myself like fighting in the waves. And I didn't know what to do with that. You know, I was just like, oh, man, like I was like, eventually I was like, well, I guess I could go to therapy because it's free and it's, you know, or like very affordable in this grad program. But over time, I think the meaning I made was that I wanted to write something that went beyond my own vanity and my own desire to see, like, yeah, to see myself reflected in a certain kind of like more shallow or self-serving way. And yeah, I think that's one of the things that I went back to when I decided, after years of trying to make my first novel work, I decided to put it in a drawer and just write something totally different. And one of the images I kept coming back to as I was writing my second novel, which became my debut, All This Could Be Different, that actually was published, was the image of myself in the waves, like trying for the shoreline, but with a sort of different emotional tenor, which was, you made it to the shoreline before, you will do it again.
Wow. There's so many things in there. Also, I should just tell you that as you were saying this story, you can't see me, I was holding on to the couch for dear life. This is my worst, my worst fear is actually a riptide. I was caught in a baby one and I almost lost my mind. So I actually can't fathom being in it for 10 minutes and keeping your brain. Because to me, that time just expanded into like an eternity. It felt like it was maybe a minute. And I felt like, oh, I've been 3 years in this place and I may never see my home again. Like it was that, yeah. the water specifically, that kind of the sweepingness of it. So it's really interesting to me that both you managed to retain the part of your lizard brain that told you to do this thing, right? Go diagonally.
Yeah.
But also that in some ways it seems like it's become a callback for you.
Yeah. Yeah, it has, in ways that I still don't fully understand.
When it was first happening for you, and you said you were meeting people and you'd hear the rushing of the ocean, did you understand in that moment where you're like, this is the ocean, I have been traumatized, this feels away, or was this too much new happening at the moment?
You know, everyone's really different. I mean, around this stuff, I think there's been a real research, like not resurgence, but maybe a massification of awareness of the T word, right? Like a lot more people are willing to talk about trauma, you know, understand the basic concept of the body keeping the score. And I think the person I was then, you know, this is sort of borderline embarrassing to admit, I was sort of really willing to entertain it as something that happened to other people. For myself, you know, a lot of how I've lived my life from when I was like a young child was sort of wishing to be this brain in a jar, wishing to ignore the fact of my body, because my body was, you know, at best like an inconvenience to everything I wanted to do with my life. I mean, I think that, you know, I grew up in an Indian community in Muscat, Oman. I had a decent amount of like gender weirdness as a child. You know, I felt most comfortable as a child, and felt and looked very genderless, and I felt real horror at the idea of becoming a woman, and particularly because I really grew up in a context where to be a woman was to be second class. Like, I, you know, like saw the future that I would have and I didn't want it. So it's sort of impossible to separate, I think, the question of like the role I felt like I would have and the fact of my body. It wasn't so much about presentation and whether I wanted long hair or short hair. You know, it was very much like, because, you know, I was surrounded by women who presented a whole bunch of different ways, but they all had the same jobs, you know, which was to, like, whether they worked, you know, a livelihood producing job or not, their job as society ordained was to maintain a household, like carry on the tasks of social reproduction, in largely unpaid ways and in ways that like husbands, men around them made clear that they were lesser than. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that that's sort of part, that's a large part of the answer. And, you know, I just, as a child, I just remember having this very strong feeling of, oh, like, I wish I just was a mind, you know? I think there are ways in which, like, if I had been a little bit younger and I'd gotten, you know, if the internet had come into my life, you know, when I was like 8 years old, as opposed to when I was like in my early teens, I think I might have been like a certain kind of like exclusively online person, you know, terminally online person, partly because that I really think the internet can give or could give like a lot of young people, especially at, you know, a generation younger than me, that's sort of like, you can actually be like an internet poltergeist without a body, and it doesn't actually matter what your embodied self is or does.
You can be the brain in the jar.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Mediated, you know, mediated by pixels and, yeah, and message boards. So yeah, but to go back to, yeah, I think you're closer to your original question, because we're about 10 tangents away. I think I just felt this real, like, looking back, I just think I had very little body awareness. And I also, you know, have just chosen for a lot of my life to be like, well, here's this thing that I don't know what to do with and seems like a lot. And I have something to do at this moment. And so I'm going to take the thing that feels like a lot and put it in a jar and, like, you know, set it aside. And I will open the jar when I have time. And I think that's sort of what I did with the, you know, when I was like, feeling like the true loud deafening roar of rushing waves when I was like meeting my classmates, you know, for the first time. I was like, well, this is unpleasant, but we don't got time to deal with it. It's like, hello, I'm Sarah. I like came here from DC.
Yeah. And the thing that's also so interesting to me is there were two different times where you talked about also sort of the shame, like being ashamed of the fact that it happened at all, right? Which is so funny because I was like, what? Because it's nature. Nature happened
of
to
course.
You. It was nature.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think there are all these ways in which, like, I, you know, like, if this happened to me now, I would have had a completely different reaction to it. But I was, you know, in my own particular 26-year-old way, a baby.
Of course. And also, it doesn't strike me as, like, I don't know. I mean, I'm very sympathetic. I feel like I will find fault with myself almost over anything. I'm really good at it. So I'm really in sympathy with your 26-year-old self. And I also, it's interesting to me that idea of shame. Like, if it were to happen to you now, where do you think it would land with you?
Yeah, I don't think my reaction would be shame. I think that I've, in the last, you know, 6 or so years, I've really developed a practice that works for me, which is try to document first for my, like, both for myself and through telling, like through letting people close to me witness me, to, I think, interrupt my previous approach of, here's this thing that happened, it's enormous, I don't know how to deal with it, and so it goes into, like, you know, a canning jar and gets pressure sealed, and I can open it at some point. And I think instead I'm like, okay, I'm picking up the phone, I'm talking to my people, I am sort of choosing to let people in when I don't fully know what happened. So I suspect that it would be a less control focused, much more trusting of, you know, my actual, like, earned community approach. The fact of the matter is, like, I grew up in a very, like, shame and honor oriented culture. I think that there are things about that that are not all bad. But I do think that it can really leave a person with a potentially lifelong feeling that you are the problem in almost any situation that allows you to make the question of your own agency tied up with whatever is happening in front of you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you just said something that even when you said it, I felt it like deep in my gut, the idea of talking to someone about something when you don't yet know what it means.
Yeah.
Which to me is always, I feel like that as a person who writes stories for a living and who sort of looks at life and tries to see the meaning in everything, that might be the hardest thing for me to do in a way, to not make it a story, to hand it to someone in story form. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally.
Like give them the raw material and say, here are all the things, instead of here's the package I've made out of it for you to digest.
Yeah, it is very difficult. I mean, it's difficult because it represents, I think, a fundamental ceding of control. And it also, I think if you're a storyteller, like one of the fundamental appeals of narrative is you do get to control it. You know, there's so much in life we can't, have a degree of management over, but the power to shape the raw, warped material of everyday life, you know, these sort of incomprehensible realms of data, or reams of data, into cogent, understandable narrative for yourself and other people, it's very hard to give up.
I'm curious about also the intersection with your work, if we can go there for a moment, because you were working on one kind of a book, mm-hmm. right? One kind of a book with a narrative that, what did you say? Kind of a, you wanted to give it a heroic, you wanted to see yourself, but also in sort of heroic terms, give that story
totally.
A larger arc. Yeah. I mean, I feel that.
And to be very clear, I don't think that there's anything wrong with that.
Right.
And in fact, I love reading books like that. I love watching films like that. It all depends on the execution, right? I think what was happening for me was I was trying to force like the writing to go a certain way in a way that wasn't true to the project itself, wasn't true to what was actually on the page. The engines behind my trying to sort of contort the story into something it wasn't supposed to be maybe ever was like the engines of my own ego and my own desire and my own maybe specifically like wounded ego, as someone who for a lot of my life felt some mixture of not being seen and not being valued for the fact of who I was.
Okay. How many years were you working on that book?
So I worked on that book, I think I would say about 7 years. It would probably have been about three or four years, I'm bad at math, at the time I went to grad school.
Right in the middle. And then you have this experience and then... And then you said something when you were first telling us the story. You were saying that when you went into the second book, mm-hmm. right? Did this come back to you then? This idea again, like were you back in the waters with this book?
Yeah, but in a totally different way. You know, I think that in some important ways, I had accessed like a certain kind of ego death for myself. You know, and I think. It allowed me to say, Sarah Matthews doesn't matter. But in this particular way, I sort of, you and I talked once and I said it was important for a past version of me to be known, like as me. And the person I am now, it's very important for me to be known, you know, fully and well by people who are actually in my life. And I hope that people out in the world know my work, but I don't care very much at all if they know me. And I think that that also, that signals that the kind of transformation that I'm talking about. So my novel, All This Could Be Different, is, you know, in short, a coming of age narrative where this young Indian woman, Sneha, has just finished college and she moves to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, a city where she knows not a soul, and holding a decent number of painful secrets with her. And then she reckons with, over the course of the book, her first job, her first love, and her first real friends. And in a lot of ways, the novel is an attempt to sort of start with an atomized and sort of pained everyman, and who's sort of taking her place as a worker in society, and trace the journey of this person over time in a way where you start out with an I, you end up with a we, you end up with this group portrait of young people forging community out of love and struggle in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So I say all that for context, you know, and to point out that the my main character is really quite unheroic, you know, she like, and I felt like I was able to access notably elevated in my eyes process of art making by not investing her with, you know, my own concerns of ego. I when I wrote it, I was like not worried about how someone was going to see me.
Yeah.
You know, there have been moments since, you know, since after the book got published where sometimes I'll become aware of someone going on about, you know, in some like forum or, you know, the Goodreads of it all about like how much they couldn't stand her. And I feel like a funny kind of prick. But I think for the, mostly because it's the way some readers have engaged with that sort of character smacks to me a little bit of a certain kind of respectability politics. Like I can't help but notice that we never talk about the question of likability, if it's a man or a white man.
Of course.
But I think it was really useful for me to be in this place of having cast aside some degree of ego. Like I really just genuinely feel like the person that I was at the time I was entering the waves in Big Sur, you know, at the time I was like, I'm going to write like a big dick immigration novel and, you know, about like an, like a queer Malayali American, like Washington DC power broker. And I think that version of me had sort of died actually. Like, and I had become not a completely different person, but someone who was meaningfully differently motivated, I think, in the kinds of things I cared the most about, and the ways in which I wanted to use like my art making. So I think that when I thought about the waves this time around, they kind of came as like visual and sort of like really vivid memory again and again, but in a warmer, friendlier way. I think when I was writing, and particularly when I was writing in the sort of like most intense stretch of writing the book, where I was working on it every single day, just like cranking it out as much as I could, I would remember the feeling of being in the waves, but the memory was, I think, less encoded as like helplessness and fear, and more the sense of you've done difficult things before. You lived for a reason. At least tell yourself that, like, you're going to write your book. You are going to get to the shoreline. And it was really uninvited meaning making. You know, I was not trying to think about any of that stuff, but it's just sort of what came to me. And I think I'm a lot more like woo-woo about writing than I was, you know, 7 years ago. And I think that there are like vaguely mystical things about it sometimes. And I think it's okay to let that stuff border your work and your process.
I mean, also when you were talking about, you know, however many years ago it was, I think a little bit more, when you were talking about doing the tasks of going to school and you were going to do this and you were going to, right? You were going to do mm-hmm. the, first you're going to do the novel, then will be the book of short stories and one will be 1 year. And even when you said that, I just was sort of giggling recklessly yeah. inside because of like, oh, it's sort of the best laid plans thing. But also mm-hmm. it really doesn't allow for that, that thing that happens, which I also believe in, that sort of that weird magical sort of portal that can open up where you just have to go in and you see what's there. And, you know, there are times when you're in it and there are times when you're firmly outside of it, but it's sort of right there near you and you have to reckon with it either way. And it's not on the task list.
Yes. Right? Yeah. I completely, completely agree with that. I think that there's something that has been lost at times with the increased cultural professionalization around creative writing.
Yes.
I have complicated feelings about it because the fact is the profession, such as it existed, was, you know, a lot whiter, a lot maler. I think that there were and continue to be all these barriers to access for people, you know, particularly from structurally marginalized backgrounds, to like be artists, to share their work, our work. And that really matters to me. So I don't wish to make it seem like it doesn't. But I will also see people online in particular sort of talk about writing in a way where it's approached like any other industry. And it's approached like that there isn't something borderline magical or mystical and complicated and difficult in this very deep and maybe ancient way. And so, yeah, I mean, I think it's good to not conflate the art making and the like industry or publishing of it all. And I think that both really matter, but the art making comes first and should come first in terms of like people figuring that out. You know, I think that we live in an attention economy. We live in this time where everyone, and certainly this includes like my younger self, right, are told like one measure of your worth and value is the content you produce and share with the world. And I'm really glad that things happened to me and people talked to me and I went on my own particular journey that left me feeling like there were things that mattered more than, you know, creating grist for the content mill, and that making real art is sort of a different matter and a different engagement with time. So all of which to say, I really agree with you, Mira. I mean, I think that the complicated thing is like, I don't know, the writing comes when and how it comes, and it has to fit into the life you're already living. And there's truly no valor in anything but following the writing through to where it leads you, you know, to facing the work, whatever it is at the moment, and making the art that you need to make.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, also one of the things that as you're talking, I was thinking about, it's not just because you're talking also about ego death. To me, it's not just that the art must be made and here is the task ahead and the sort of the itemization of it, but it's also the need to be visible in the moment you are making it as the maker, which I think to me sort of gets in the way of that, of that other thing we're talking about, which is when your ego can sort of let go and let the thing be itself.
Yes.
Right? I was just reading, by the way, yesterday I was just reading Linda Barry's What It Is for the Millionth Time. Have you read that?
No, I haven't.
Oh, I'm going to
give you... But I love Linda Barry.
I'm sending you a copy immediately. I'll just drop it by your house. It's really just so brilliant for so many things. But she does talk about like this sort of the nervousness around this idea of like, is it good or does it suck? Which is our own, you know, ego problem as we're making art, but also the ability to sit in the silence of that question long enough to let the thing become alive. Right.
I love that. I love that so much.
Me too. And the thing that I've realized is it is for me in many ways, the opposite of performing the art of writing. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's the opposite of saying, I am writing. I'm a writer and I am writing. Whenever I'm doing that, I feel like that becomes louder to me in some way than the part of sitting quiet with it, if that makes sense.
Yeah. No, I love that. Like, no notes from me. I completely agree with that framing.
And you know, do you remember a few years ago when was it Michaela Cole who gave that beautiful speech after what was it? I May Destroy You, who said, don't be afraid to disappear.
Yeah, no, I remember that profoundly, actually. Right? Yeah. No, it's, there's real wisdom there. It goes very counter to a lot of the messages like artists are getting now, like artists of any stripe are getting now, which is make content, be visible, you know, like command your market share in the attention economy.
That second book, I know you wrote it. Can we just talk about how much time it took you to write the second book? Because I know you've been working on the first for 7 years, yeah?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you let that go. And the book that we all know about, All This Could Be Different, right? Yeah. That one that's come out, that one you wrote, how long did that take?
Yeah. I think it's sometimes more helpful to just like talk about, like rather than give like a one sentence answer.
Yes, of course.
I think it's just sort of helpful to sort of like explain the mechanism of how I wrote it. So in early 2020, which is about the time that I was starting to be like, maybe I should just, you know, like freaking give up on this other, you know, like 7 year long project. And I was like, well, I'm not ready to give it up yet. I'm going to work on a short story. So I started writing these pages of a short story, what I thought was a short story that was like about 12 pages. And I was like, I don't even know what this is. Like, there's this voice that really makes, like, is burning in my brain, but I don't know the plot. I couldn't figure out what it was. And the short story was called Milwaukee. And I was like, this wants to be like a like disaffected queer love story with like a sarcastic protagonist, like talking shit about her corporate office job. But then I was like, what's the thing? What actually happens in the story? I don't know. And you know, it was sort of a fictionalization of the year that I lived in Milwaukee in that short story. So not knowing what to do with it and how to create a beginning, middle, and end, I put it aside. Many things happened in the next 5 months in my life in 2020. COVID came for all of our asses. I lost a bunch of my freelance gigs. I worked through a big, big old depression that I'd been sort of in for many months, with love and support. I was doing, with a whole bunch of other people, a lot of mutual aid organizing, starting in March 2020. So like March 2020 to like July or June 2020, I was not writing one bit. And then around sometime in the summer of 2020, I was talking to like my fellow organizers and I just said, hey, like, I really want to write a book. I have been thinking about it, you know, like basically every moment that I've been awake, including when I've been doing organizing stuff. I feel like I have this like very slim amount of runway because I had just qualified for pandemic unemployment insurance. And I was just sort of frank with them that Bed-Stuy Strong, the mutual aid organization I'd founded, was a full-time unpaid job for me, you know? And so I was like, something has to change. And the way I see it at the time was, I was like, maybe I can write this novel, sell it for a little bit of money. And that gives me like more time and the ability to pay my bills. And, you know, my fellow organizers many of whom have become some of my closest friends, were like, we got you, we will split up your job, you know, cause it was a job, and take on more of the labor of organizing, write your book. Like, you know, there was still the expectation that I come to meetings and do stuff. Like you said, I went from maybe like 45 hours a week of, organizing work to, you know, maybe like six a week. And I just wrote like my hair was on fire for like 4 months. And at the end of those 4 months, I was like, oh shit, I love this book. And it really was an experience that I had not had.
Wait, hold on. That's amazing. Yeah. Can you tell me about that? You really, you felt that, like you felt it.
I just was like, I mean, I don't know, Mira, like I had really maybe in my life written like one or two other things that were like short stories that I really loved. And so much of my experience with writing, you know, in some ways it like reminded me of my experiences, like when I was very young, of dating, of being like, well, this is awful to like subject myself to, you know, the sort of the pressures of like wanting to be chosen, wanting, you know, all this other stuff. But there was such desire, like in, I think in both cases, there was like enough desire and hunger to make it worthwhile. But I think particularly when I was very young and for a long time in writing, it's not like I was loved back. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not like the writing loved me back. And most often I would come to the end of something and be like, well, I see promise in this, like, but it's not good or great, which is kind of a hard thing to feel, especially once you have given up, you know, like a salary and benefits and, you know, a certain kind of position on the escalator of middle-class life to try to do a thing that you really love. So I came to the end of, yeah, the novel I wrote, and I was like, I just had this feeling that I can only describe as like I have to imagine this is what like heroin felt like, feels like. I just felt euphoria, like total joy, the like total sheer distilled joy of making something and knowing like this is going to live.
Mm.
And yeah, I think everything after that happened. So and what I mean by that is I found an agent. The agent and I worked on revising the book. That took, you know, that took like another, I think like 3 weeks, because I was like working like a madman in a way that I really don't advise to other people. But I was, I think, had some very specific things going on in my life, right? Like I had this feeling that of bills coming due, the need to like get a normal full-time job at some point, et cetera, et cetera. So I think all these things like made me work like crazy. I also think that like doing a, like organizing work around the clock also had, you know, put me in a sort of different mindset than around the work of writing, where before I'd really tried to approach it as like, well, writing can be like my 9-to-5 or whatever. And yeah, I think, so we sold the book, and then in the year that fall, no, I feel like a lot of people conflate selling a book and publishing a book, right? And you and I know that there's a lot of stuff that happens in between. There were sort of, I think a total of, over the year that followed, there was a total of like 2.5 months of like intense editing, you know? So, you know, if you add up all, like, so I think that there's, sometimes I conversationally would tell people when they would ask me like, so when did you write your book? Like, when did you actually write it? Was this the book that you'd been working on for a long time? I was like, you know, I would be like, no, like this was the book that I mostly wrote in four to five months in 2020. But I think that mostly does a lot of work. You know, I think that the reality is like, especially if you believe that like writing is thinking, and if you believe that like, as I do, that I needed to sort of make all the mistakes I did with that first unrelated book, and then sort of use my learning for all this could be different. It's entirely true to say that the process of writing All This Could Be Different took like almost 9 years.
Yes.
I think, and I think that a lot of the, like the drafting happened the most intensively in 2020, a year where my life just sort of like molted and reformed like 800 times.
Yeah. You know, and I'm so, thank you so much. Cause that's exactly what I know. And I know that's the soundbite that goes out all the time. Oh, it was done in 4 months, but I know how much went behind that, right? Mm-hmm. Through, honestly, this thing that you're talking about, which is getting pulled out by a riptide, right? Like, mm-hmm. So much went in to those 4 months that is unaccounted for in that thing. And I guess the reason that I wanted to talk about it a little is because I feel like that to me is sort of the opposite of this idea that I think is proliferated and makes other writers feel insane, which is, oh, this work of genius can be done in 4 months. What have you done? You've been wasting your time, which I don't think that's your story at all. I think your story is so many things. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, I think that's why I've sort of not always known how to talk about this well, because there's, I think the, you know, like desire to be candid. And I think what I just, everything I shared with you was like the true and candid story, right? But I think that when I was talking earlier in this conversation about the, like, I think skewed incentives of professionalized life as a writer, I'm really talking about the incentives and mechanisms of capitalism. I think it is sort of seeing your work not as art, which to me means many things, but it's something that transcends you as a person. It's a gift to the future. It's all these things. And it's sort of setting aside these questions that are like, some of them are like ancient and mystical and complicated, right? For the logic of the marketplace and the attention economy. And how am I doing compared to the other people in my cohort? Oh, this person got this one other thing more than me. This person got, you know, like $20,000 more than me, you know, for their advance. I completely understand why people care about that stuff. And I would be lying if I said I didn't. But I also think that there's something lost when these become our only metrics. You know, how quick can you produce and for how much?
I just am wondering about this one little thing, which is you said you burst out laughing when you got to the shore, yeah?
Yeah.
Do you know what was in that? Like, why the laughing?
I don't know. I really don't. I remember what it felt like, which was that like a speaker was suspended about 10 feet above me and it was doing the laughing. Like it really was this moment of like true disconnect from my body.
Mm.
I think I was glad to be alive. I think I just really spent a lot of the, you know, 3 hours that followed that, which was me being ice cold, draped in a lot of blankets with the car heat on full while my partner like drove us to like the nearest town, you know, and tried to keep conversation with me going because, you know, he was really worried about me. And I was kind of loopy. And as an aside, he was the one who was like, I implore you to tell your close friends and to tell people close to you this happened and don't like lock it away in, you know, a wardrobe, which is very smart. And I'm glad for that. But I think that the thing that I just felt in my bones was, I'm so glad I'm alive.
Threshold is produced by Jordan Kistner and Drew Broussard. Music and editing by Laura Faye Osherwood of Arthur Moon. Our art is by Lorelei Grossman. Special thanks to our hosts at Lit Hub Radio. You can find more about our show, listen to past episodes, and get in touch at our website, thisisthresholds.com. Don't forget to rate and review our show at Apple Podcasts. Thanks. We'll see you next week.